Good day, folks. Recording this in anticipation of the publication of our second episode, this time with Dr. Robert Freichberg. This episode, very interesting. Dr. Freichberg has been in wound care for over 40 years. He's a podiatrist by training. He's published 200 articles, it feels like. And he is just an absolute fount of knowledge about the history of wound care. Dr. Freichberg has an encyclopedic knowledge of the research in his field, and he's also a member of Open Wound Research as our chief research officer. So I get to enjoy having this library of Alexandra on our meetings, and I think you guys will enjoy the insight he gives about the history of wound care, some of the figures that I didn't know about necessarily, some of the history of how things have changed or not changed. And I just think it's such a gift for us to have him join us. And I hope you enjoy the episode. And again, check us out on our YouTube channel, on our LinkedIn page. And we have podcast versions on Spotify, Apple Music, and other podcast avenues. So hope you enjoy it. Leave any comments, suggestions, etc. They're always greatly appreciated. Thank you. Hello, welcome to the Open Wound Research Podcast. This is episode number 2, and our guest today is Dr. Robert Freichberg, a respected wound care clinician and researcher. We're really excited to have Dr. Freichberg with us today, and welcome to the podcast, Dr. Freichberg.
Thank you, it's really good to be here.
It's such a pleasure for us as well. Just a quick introduction for the audience. Dr. Freichberg, as I mentioned earlier, as a respected wound care clinician and researcher with about 46 years worth of experience in wound care research and practice. He's a graduate of the California College of Podiatric Medicine in San Francisco, and also graduated Harvard University, where he received his master's in public health with a concentration in quantitative methods. He's also part of many professional societies, including but not limited to the American Podiatric Medical Association and the American Diabetes Association. He also has written more than 150 publications. So with that impromptu and wide-ranging introduction, I think we've captured just a part of what Dr. Freichberg has done in the community. So perhaps, Dr. Freichberg, to start, we can go back in time to when you chose to go to podiatric school. What kind of drove that decision going to medicine as a Jersey boy?
Okay. All right. Thanks, Willie. I think what you said there as an introduction is just a measure of my longevity in this field for many years. I originally wanted to be an oceanographer when I went to college, University of Rhode Island, and then I was discouraged from that. They said, well, you'll never get into the graduate school if you go to undergraduate school here. So I said, well, okay, I guess I'm going to change, you know, because I always love the water. I guess that always raises the question, well, how did I end up in Phoenix, Arizona, if I love the water? What? But regardless, my mother was a nurse, you know, and I had, as I grew older, and certainly in college, my circle of friends led me to meet podiatrists who were fairly prominent in their field in New Jersey and the New York area. And I was looking for something to do, and I figured, you know, I could try podiatry, because they were very advanced in their training, and or not in their training, but more in their practices back then. People don't realize it now because there's so many medical schools, both DO and allopathic medicine. Back in the early and mid 70s, there were not as many medical schools, and the competition was very, very intense, because there were so few slots. And I guess I didn't have enough wherewithal to really try to push to apply to 50 schools. I just wasn't really that interested. I was having too much fun in college back in those days anyway. But because of my meeting podiatrists who were very advanced in their field, I applied to a podiatry school. And back in those hippie days, I figured, what better place to go to school than San Francisco? So I went to school in San Francisco. And the bonus was that in the mid-70s, early to mid-70s, there was a new experiment in medical education where they were compressing 4 years into 3 years. And that didn't last long. I don't know why, because it was fine for me. And I was the first class to go in to the accelerated three-year program, which just meant we had fewer vacations and we concentrated more into the time that we had. So, you know, summers were more abbreviated. Winter breaks and holiday breaks were more abbreviated. But it was great, and I had a great time going to school in San Francisco. So I did fine. I was serious about it, you know, studying every night after class before I went out, and enjoyed ourselves and enjoyed the sights of San Francisco, which, you know, was a wonderful place back then. And so I completed studies there. The interesting thing is that I really only wanted to go to certain few places for residencies. And residency programs back then, as people wouldn't realize now, were very, very difficult to obtain in podiatry because there weren't enough slots for all the graduates that we had. I mean, there were fewer schools. I think we had 4 or 5 schools back then, but there were not enough residency slots. And most slots that were available were just 1 year slots. And there were only a handful of places with 2 year, and there were really no 3 year residency slots. So I was just very selective because I thought, well, I did pretty good in school, so I'm going to be selective and just apply to the ones that I wanted. And when the wonderful match day came around, I was not matched, you know, because I didn't want to go to the residency at the school that I went to in San Francisco. I just wanted to move on. And so I was scrambling for something to do, you know, looking into the service, which probably would have been a good idea, and other opportunities. And lo and behold, in about a month of really depression and wondering what I was going to do, after a month, I got a call from the program that I most wanted, which was my number one choice, And he says, I hope you're still available because we had to pull out of the match because of internal problems or funding problems or something. And so we hope you're still available because you were always our first choice, which was very fortuitous because you were obligated for the most part to go to the programs to which you are matched. And I probably would have had a great conflict at that time. So I was very fortunate and I matched up my primary program that I was interested in. And that's how I went to Boston. And then from there, my career developed. So that's it in a nutshell. But it was interesting how it all worked out. And really, for viewers who can't realize it now, it was really difficult getting into schools back in the early and mid-70s. There just weren't enough slots. Even New Jersey, where I grew up, did not have its own medical school. Now it's got 2 or 3 schools. But back then, there was nothing. My brother, much smarter than I, much more accomplished. He was a serious student in high school, or I can't say I was really a serious student. He went to William & Mary, and he was an excellent student, and even he didn't get a program his first year of trying. So that was really eye-opening back then. He eventually did, and he did very well. But anyway, interesting story about the differences between the 70s and medical education compared to how it is right now.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that history, but yeah, it makes sense. There was a lot of investment in higher education, I guess, to build out those professional schools.
Oh, yeah. I think it's easier now, to be quite honest with you, to get into a medical school and podiatry school. You know, sometimes we ask about, well, how was the education back then? You know, I found it to be, where I went to school in California, to be pretty comprehensive. I mean, I mean, frankly, I learned most of my medicine from pathology, our pathology instructor, who was fabulous, and of course our medical courses. And you often wonder, well, how can a 3-year program train you to be an effective resident? You know, if you did get a residency, because some of my fellow students actually went right into practice, because you were not even required to have a residency in podiatry to get a license back then. Mm-hmm. In fact, most practicing podiatrists back in the 70s did not have residencies, because there just hadn't been those available. So the point is, you know, I got accepted into a Harvard training hospital program, and I felt perfectly knowledgeable to engage in the well-rounded residency that I did, you know, because I was working hand in hand right from the beginning in the Joslin Clinic with other Harvard-trained students, or from anywhere around the world, or around the world and around the country, and I just dealt right in. I mean, I was very serious about it at that point. I know you don't believe that now, but I was really serious about things back then, because I said, I'm going to do as best I can, and I'm going to make sure that they know that podiatrists are here for a reason, and that we have our role in this big medical complex, and I was going to do my very best. And things just went on from there. So, and that's really how I had kind of developed my interest in diabetes and diabetic foot, which actually started when I was a student. My senior year, I actually did a external rotation, as we call it, in the hospital in New Jersey, Hackensack Hospital, where I was born. And I thought that was really interesting. And that's where I saw my first Charcot foot and the first episode of gangrene that I can remember. But Charcot foot really stuck out in my mind. And that pushed me forward to apply to the Deaconess, and which was part of the Joslin Clinic group, more or less. And so that kind of set me on the career that I took. And believe it or not, in the mid to late 70s, diabetic foot was not the big popular subject matter that it is now. I mean, you know, there are people going into sports medicine and this and that, you know, pediatrics. But I was always focused on diabetes, diabetic foot, Charcot foot, certainly before it was popular. Now everybody's an expert in diabetic foot. Everybody's an expert in Charcot foot. That's why I always say, well, where were you 10, 20 years ago, you know, or 30 years ago when it wasn't so popular? But, you know, that's the evolution of our profession. And some people are just very, very, very good at it. I was just fortunate that I was surrounded by really high level people in my early years, and then meeting other high-level people, and that kind of pushes you in the right direction. Whereas I think if I was in a small community hospital with less academic people surrounding me, I wouldn't have kind of taken the path that I took. You know, and that's so it really, really is important, that who you associate with, who you're influenced by. You know, and I wasn't really influenced by the podiatrist necessarily, but I was influenced by the giants in vascular surgery. And we're talking early vascular surgery in this country, back in the late 70s and that, but really giants in the Harvard system who really pushed for revascularization when these procedures were in their infancy. You know, I like to use the name Frank Wheelock, who was really the head vascular surgeon, Carl Hoare, who was another vascular surgeon, and these guys were really, really top of their field and really pioneers. And people might know the name Gary Gibbons. Gary Gibbons was a resident, I think he finished 6 months after I started as a chief surgery resident. He went into vascular surgery as well, and this is before there were even vascular surgery fellowships. But we recognize the important cohesion between podiatry and vascular surgery, you know, over 40 years ago, over 40 years ago. So, I don't want to belabor this, but we often can learn from history. I'm trying to make your job easier as well, so you don't have to think of questions. Okay, because I know your limitations as far as that goes.
This is great because I think, you know, when I came into wound care, I like history. I like to understand the past, and I think that's the future doesn't mirror the past, but it sure rhymes. And so it's always interesting to see where this field progressed from and the learnings that we've kind of built upon. And it's interesting for me to hear that diabetic foot also wasn't particularly an interesting part of podiatry or medicine not at that really. Point.
Not really. And I was going to say, where I was, you know, what did I know as a young Jersey boy, you know, out of podiatry school in California? I went to, you know, Deaconess Hospital, where I never rotated either. I just interviewed there, and the Joslin Clinic. And I knew there was a specialty in diabetes there. But then I got there and I started to become a little bit more scholarly, if you would, because I wasn't scholarly at all in podiatry school for the most part. Neither were my professors, for that matter. But if you think about, as I was saying, where you train and who you train with, you might be well aware of the multidisciplinary concept that you hear all the time now. You know, multidisciplinary management of the diabetic foot. And again, diabetic foot was always my forte and interest. So, and I kept saying, well, gee, you know, they've been having multidisciplinary diabetic foot rounds at the Deaconess Hospital for ages, long before I was there. And then read a paper from New England Journal of Medicine, 1934, by Elliot P. Joslin, the founder of the Joslin Clinic, New England Journal of Medicine, talking about the menace of diabetic gangrene, 1934. What did he talk about? Problems of gangrene, how they're increasing in his patients, how patients are suffering needlessly, that patients need to be checking their feet, they need to have proper footwear, they need to have cleanliness of their feet, they need to see their doctor for good diabetes control. Remember, that's just when insulin was starting to come into common practice in the U.S. And guess who Dr. Joslin rounded with on a regular basis? His podiatrist back, I forget what his name was, but he was a very well-respected podiatrist who was not surgical in nature at all in those days. They were more chiropodist. But they relied heavily on their podiatrist. So he had his team. He had his specialized foot care nurses. He had his internists, as well as himself, Dr. Bailey. I think there was a Dr. Root too, but there was a Dr. Bailey. And he had his surgeons, the McKittrick brothers, and several others, and his podiatrists. And that was the nucleus of the multidisciplinary clinic, including education for the patients and having foot rounds. And even when I started, and I believe to this day, every week they had multidisciplinary foot rounds at the Deaconess Hospital, where they would wheel the patients in on their stretchers and they would have a discussion amongst all the doctors after the case was presented. This is the patient's problem. That was the start of the multidisciplinary clinic. And as you may realize, everybody's touting multidisciplinary clinics now. You know, well, you know, it started with Mike Edmonds in his Quarterly Journal of Medicine publication in 1986. I said, no, it didn't. Mike revived the concept that the rest of the world had kind of lost, but I always say, no, he didn't. Look at 1934, Joslin published his paper. So it's going back to the literature, because as you well know, there's really nothing new under the sun. If you just look back far enough, you'll be able to see that what you think is unique and novel is not really unique or a novel thought. Maybe your techniques are new now, your technologies, your diagnostic abilities, but many of the things, concepts that we have now are not especially novel. They're just, I'm not saying all of them. Obviously, there's new concepts in that, but many of the basic concepts that we have now have been around for a long, long time. So that's enough for that historical perspective. But I always find it very interesting when you go back into the old literature and you really read what was present a century ago or so, you know, or longer.
Speaking about the old literature, by our count, my assistant looked at how many articles you've written, and the count came to about 150 articles. And I know we joke a little bit with you that you were publishing before I was born.
Probably.
And so in 1977, I was born in 1979. And so, you know, you became studious in school. What kind of drove that need for you to write, publish, and add to the existing knowledge? And how has that changed over time? I know you are an editor of a couple of publications, or at least an editorial board. What kind of drove that first publication and your ongoing publication and research?
Very interesting, because I don't think it's that prevalent, certainly not in our profession. And I'm talking podiatry. So I can be somewhat critical, but yet I've seen a great evolution in it. But go back to the 70s, you know, podiatry was not a new profession. It was certainly evolving from the old chiropody to more of a surgical and more medical management. But surgery was new back in the 50s and 60s and that. But academics was not, you know. I just this past week, I recall telling somebody, you know, my degree is a DPM, Doctor of Podiatric Medicine. And I always kidded because I didn't get much mentorship from my professors, if you want to call them professors, in school. And I call it Doctor of Pinball Machine because I used to see my professors always in the student lounge playing pinball rather than having kind of academic discussions, which I kind of felt that they should be having. All right. But again, my first publication, actually, I started to write when I was a senior in podiatry school because one of my early mentors, Ray Locke from Englewood, New Jersey, who my mother had worked with, he was at the hospital where my mother had worked, was really a pioneer. And very, very, very thoughtful about many things. And he says, "Now we got to publish about this new way that I handle, I think it was plantar scars and the way that he does plantar incisions to minimize scars and that." So interestingly, my first two publications were in the same journal of the American Podiatry Association, in January of my first year as a resident, which is unique because I, you know, we had submitted them when I was still a student. So it was mentorships. But I also remember something that always stuck with me. We had a journal editor of that podiatry journal. And of course, as a podiatrist, I didn't really read too many other journals. But I remember an editorial that he wrote. And this was Dalton McGlamory, who many of your listeners would know of, who is from Atlanta, Georgia, a really good thinker, very, very well respected, great surgeon in Atlanta, Georgia. And when he was the editor, I remember he said something to the effect that authorship is the key to notoriety or the key to making progress in your own profession and your own professional development, something of that nature. And that always stuck with me. So I always was thinking about, well, you know, we need to be publishing more. You know, obviously people publish, but most of the publications back then did not come out of the podiatry school. So I know I'm kind of critical here, but it's absolutely true. You know, most publications come from residency programs or people out in the field who just have an interesting case or something else. But back in the late 70s, you know, there wasn't a lot of good mentorship in the podiatry schools and programs. But luckily, as I said, I was surrounded even in my residency by really good people who are really top of their game. And they kind of pushed me towards this. And one of the best, earliest publications was with, God bless him, George Kozak, who was a physician at the Joslin Clinic who I became very friendly with. And back in the late 70s, there were very few publications on Charcot foot, very few. In fact, a lot of people didn't have any idea what Charcot foot was, or was not, they were not familiar with it. But again, things have changed. Every decade, more and more and more interest in these entities, to the point now I can't keep up with the literature on Charcot foot or diabetic foot because everybody is involved in it now. But again, we have to go back 40 something years when the study of diabetes and complications was really starting to come into a fruition, certainly lower extremity complications. Okay. Sorry, I've said enough. I've said plenty.
No apologies. What I really like about this format is we're able to talk about these things in depth. And the idea is to have experts like yourself really delve deeply into a subject and give us history that we may not be aware of. I know personally in this conversation, but in other conversations we have, I learn a great deal because there's a historical arc to this. And with the new technologies that we see in the course of either managing a practice or doing research, having that ability to look into the past is really important. And I think a lot of times, when people come with new technologies, they're not, to your point, that new. It's usually a change in technology, in the underlying delivery method. Or in the worst case, it's writing a paper that perhaps spins things a little bit too far, which we've seen as well. Please take your time. This is fascinating to me personally, but also fascinating to the audience, I think, that want to kind of delve into this. So can you talk a little bit more to me about the Charcot foot? Because I see it everywhere. Everyone writes about it. It's omnipresent pretty much in the literature. I know in 2010, you wrote The Diabetic Charcot Foot and Principles in Management. If you had to compare what was known, let's say in 2010, when you wrote that, to what is known in practice now, what would be the major differences? What are the major advances that you've seen or non-advances?
Well, non-advances is a good point as well. Going back to 1978 and before, there had been some very good seminal papers on Charcot foot. Some very good that I still refer to now, like from Harris and Brand in 1966, J.T.H. Johnson publishing his fabulous monograph in Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery in January of 1967. And then, I had done my little work, but I wasn't really academic. I don't even think I even knew about them back then when I published in 78. But I had the interest in Charcot foot and started to see more and more publications in it. And I think the first publication, the first textbook that I saw that really had anything about it was really Marv Levin's book, which I studied and used in my podiatry training too. And he had the Diabetic Foot, Medical Surgical Management of Diabetic Foot. And that was the first medical textbook on Charcot foot, unless we include Eichenholz's monograph on Charcot foot, which published also in 1966 out of, he was in the Bronx VA system actually. And that's where we get the Eichenholz classification from. So these were really interesting series, but there was no textbook on diabetic Charcot foot. And I saw that for years. I'd been a co-editor and chapter contributor of an editor of a lower extremity diabetic foot textbook. Actually, my first one was back in 1991, High Risk Foot and Diabetes Mellitus, and we really delved very much into the Charcot foot, but there was no textbook. So I said, I think we need a textbook on Charcot foot. So who was I? In 2010, I just gathered up my colleagues that I had met over the years and said, hey, we want to do a textbook on Charcot foot. And I got a publishing house to to agree to publish it. And so we published the 2010, the Diabetic Charcot Foot. And at that point, it was really up to date. To get right to the point, if you really I think we might understand a little bit more about the pathophysiology, the inflammatory theory. But if you really go back in history, you know, we know we have the French theory of pathogenesis, the neurovascular theory. Then we have the neurotraumatic theory of Charcot, pathophysiology, if you will, by Volkmann and Virchow, who were almost contemporaries of Charcot. And the French theory was really Charcot, which we now know through the work of Brouwer and Allman, I think in 1981, publishing really their views on how the neurovascular reflex theory really is autonomic neuropathy leading to sympathetic failure and increased bone blood flow. And then we merge that with the neurotraumatic theory of development in a neuropath of trauma imposed on a neuropathic foot with loss of pain sensation allows a vicious cycle to ensue because they just keep walking on a fractured or injured foot and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And then Steve Edelman in 1988, who was also a Joslin fellow at that time, put forth a paper that kind of combined thing, a modern theory, which was a combined pathogenesis of both the neurovascular and the neurotraumatic theories. So what I'm getting at is I don't think our pathogenesis really has changed much, our understanding, except this is always interesting. I tell this a lot. And if I'm getting too far down in the weeds, just tell me, Zoli. I can remember sitting, I must have been a first year resident at the Deaconess, talking with a Joslin fellow, Skip Vignotti, who went on to become a Joslin attending and a bigwig at Lilly in Indianapolis. And I remember sitting with Skip and saying, you know, that there's got to be a missing link because every neuropathic patient who sustains an injury does not develop Charcot foot, which is really considered to be a relatively rare disease when you look at the whole diabetes spectrum, less than 1% incidence. But if you look at people with neuropathy, based on Cofield's, I think it was 1984 or 86 study of just neuropathic patients, they had almost 30%. So then we say, okay, well, we know it's only in neuropathic patients. But why just 30%, if you would? You know, many diabetic patients, neuropathic patients who have a fracture just go on to heal, you know, with whatever, like a stress fracture or a metatarsal fracture, they'll go on to heal without any bone or joint destruction that you see in Charcot. But yet in some people, a small twist or a sprain of the ankle can lead to this aggressive inflammatory response that results in this full manifestation of osteoarthropathy or the Charcot foot. What is the missing link? And this is what I was discussing with my friend Skip Vignotti. And I said, what is it? And it wasn't until Dario Patoco published his paper, and I think it was 2006 in Diabetes Care, on single nucleotide polymorphisms for the Rankel OPG axis of bone dissolution and bone osteoclastogenesis, et cetera, where he starts talking about a single nucleotide polymorphism for the osteoprotegerin gene, which allows for an abnormal aggressive response, an unmitigated response to aggressive rank L production, which leads to aggressive bone destruction. I said, there's the missing link. It's got to be. Now, it hasn't been fully proven, but I swear that there has to be some genetic component. Because here's the other question. Why do we see the same entity occur in tabes dorsalis, syphilis, that Charcot himself first postulated in his 1983 article in Archives of Neurology on the pied tabétique, the Tibetic foot? Why do we see it in Hansen's disease and leprosy, which is what Paul Brand published in 1966, which is what Shibata was talking about when he published his famous paper on Charcot ankle reconstruction, where he introduced stage zero to it. Why do we see it in alcoholism with severe peripheral neuropathy or post-HIV treatment where you get a toxic neuropathy of the nerves? So you're seeing the same process develop through all these different disease states, all who have a neuropathy, but not everybody who has those neuropathies are going to develop Charcot foot. So there's got to be some trigger or some predisposing trigger or predisposing, I should say, factor that allows for an unregulated osteoclastogenesis, which leads to unregulated inflammatory response and unregulated response to injury. So this is how things go. So there's not a lot of, there might be new theories how to treat it, like aldose reductase inhibitors, which were a wash. They came out in the mid-90s. No, that's not going to do it because it was attacking the osteoclastogenesis with bisphosphonates and aldose reductase inhibitors and for neuropathy, bisphosphonates, which proved ineffective to actually mitigate the response. Then you have human parathyroid hormone, well, from Nina Petrova, that really hasn't been proven effective to mitigate the healing and the expedite any healing. And then denosumab, which is an anti-rank L monoclonal antibody, that hasn't really gone too far. So what I'm getting at, even since in 2010, we started to realize there are more and more papers on surgical management, which you did not see too much. Although let's go back in history again, the Wayback Machine, to 1967 with J.T.H. Johnson's fabulous paper in Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, where he was talking about operating on these Charcot feet. And he says, don't be afraid of it. Just respect the magnitude of the disease and expect trouble and plan on, you know, lengthier times for healing these problems. But you can't just go in willy-nilly and operate on these acutely inflamed feet. So to get back to your question, really, is there anything dramatically new? No, because I think we're going back. We understand it's acutely inflamed. You have to rest that foot to get it to calm down. And it's going to take a long time to calm it down. Now I think more people are comfortable doing surgery on it, but hopefully recognize that surgery itself can be an inciting event for reactivation. Okay. And maybe external fixation and percutaneous pinning and stabilization, that might be something with promise for the future, but we need larger studies. Okay. We don't know which patients are best treated conservatively, medical management, and which patients and which sites are best treated surgically. Although in our 2011 Charcot Task Force that was led by Lee Rogers and a bunch of us participated, when we went to Charcot's hospital in Paris, La Salpêtrière, we realized Charcot ankles always do bad and they rarely will fuse and stabilize. So on these deformities, these joints, your best option is early surgical stabilization. Okay. And that I think still holds the same now, except now we realize any ankle fracture neuropathic patient needs to be treated as Charcot, because those are the ones that are going to go bad as quickly as they'll go better. So there's not a lot of new things. There's not a lot of new medicines. There's not a lot of new treatments. Maybe more people are comfortable doing surgery on Charcot feet, but there haven't been any great population-wide studies because there were more single-center studies from experienced people, sometimes not that experienced people, where we're getting more and more case history. So we know much more about how to treat it, but have the underlying mechanisms that we understand changed in the last 20 years? Not really. But I think we have a better understanding of this rank L, rank OPG axis than we did. We have a better understanding of the inflammatory process. And this is due to William Jeffcoat's early papers in, I think, 2003, really talking about the rank L OPG access and the inflammatory components. But really, it still goes back to the neurovascular theory that was postulated way back when, and the neurotraumatic theory way back when, and then we just now have to combine things, you know? So a lot of new interest in it, new papers, but has anything dramatically changed other than our greater interest in surgical management? No, but I think people need to realize these are really complicated people and that we really need to treat them as JTH Johnson said, don't treat them with dread, but treat them with a respect for the magnitude of the underlying disease. And that still holds true, 50 some odd years later. So again, nothing new under the sun. It's all back there if you care to look for it.
Let me ask you a question. So let's tie this into something that's really interesting to me. And we've been talking about, as many listeners might not know, I left this out at the start, but you're our chief research officer at Open Wound Research, bringing this into the world of pressure ulcers, right? So one question that I've always had, and this is from my background of having been a partner in a wound care consultancy where we saw predominantly pressure ulcers, why is it that one patient has the same endogenic factors, the same exogenic factors, but one develops a pressure ulcer and the other doesn't? And in our last episode, I was talking to Harm Smit, who you met in the Netherlands in Utrecht, He's a biologist. And he said, he mirrors almost exactly what you're saying. There's a genetic component to these patients that is implicit or unobserved, and we don't quite understand yet. And that plays a big role in the manifestation of pressure ulcers. And with pressure ulcers, as I learned from you, I include patients who have ulcerations of the foot on bony prominences. So what's your thought about what you've learned in the world of diabetes research that is applicable in pressure ulcer research in terms of how it's developing? Because it's behind diabetic foot ulcer research.
Right.
What do you think about that sort of that interplay with pressure ulcers?
Now, can I give you my exposition or my disquisition on pressure ulcers, pressure wounds? I have been, as I've said, a diabetic foot person all of my career, but through you and working with Ryan Dirks from United Wound Healing and us working together on open wound research, I've realized several things. Pressure ulcers far supersede diabetic foot ulcers in numbers, as you well know, Zwelly. I mean, you've got a great experience in this area. Pressure ulcers are the most frequent chronic wound. They're the most understudied type of chronic wound. Okay. Diabetic foot is where all the interest is, but I see the future going to pressure ulcer research, as we've discussed many times. I see the future going to mobile wound care as the primary source for patients to study, because mobile wound care is really where all the ulcers really are. Any brick and mortar center might have, what, 1,000, several hundred unique patients per year, whereas, as you well know, we can have 30,000 in a large wound care group, and in our own work that you're doing so much work for on our pressure registry, 4,500, 5,000 unique pressure injury patients in a year, just pressure injuries. That's not wall wounds together. So I think that's where the future lies. I tell everybody that, right now it's diabetic foot ulcer here, but let's look at pressure ulcer research. Why was that the case? That's the interesting thing. And again, I bow to your knowledge because of your experience in that field, and certainly our other colleagues and Ryan and his group. But I think it's because it's been understudied, because sponsors or the medical device industries, and that includes advanced therapies for wound care that we're very familiar with, they shied away from it because they thought, well, we can't really do anything there. We can't get good results there. I said, well, that doesn't make sense. Of course you can if you follow all the basics of offloading and proper patient assessment, looking for infection, treating infection when it's present, proper classifying wound, proper turning, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, and you could disagree if I'm wrong, I think that misconception in the old days or historically was because in most skilled nursing facilities, nursing homes, long-term care facilities, they had a wound nurse who took care of all these wound patients. And that wound nurse might not have had any great experience or certification in wound care and wasn't up to speed on that. So maybe the results weren't as good as we would want to or expect now. However, as I see it, especially since the pandemic, where I've seen the practice of mobile wound care exploding, certainly in our country, because patients don't want to go to a hospital or a clinic. They want the clinic to come to them. That's why the numbers are out in the homes and nursing homes and facilities and patients' homes. And I think with these professional mobile wound care groups, they have protocols, evidence-based protocols that follow guidelines. And so I think we're seeing far better organized care, and you're going to see better results. And so that's why I like to bring our results to these sponsors, as we're doing with our liftoff registry, and saying, look at the results that we're getting. This is our standard of care. Our standard of care is far better than what you ever thought before. What would happen if we use advanced therapies or your advanced products or devices on these wounds and get that increased, enhanced level of healing? So I see a lot of things changing for the future. To your exact point, I don't know. I don't consider myself a pressure ulcer expert, but it's interesting to note, as we found in the registry, most of our pressure ulcers are on the heel, whether they're diabetic or not, which was really a big surprise to me, to be quite honest with you. You know, after all my years in the VA and always focusing on offload those heels, offload the heels, offload the heels, it's just driven into you to find that we're finding all these pressure wounds primarily on the heel, which is probably the easiest thing to offload, don't you think? Where we just have to offload these. Now, many patients have PAD. Unfortunately, many have undiagnosed PAD, peripheral arterial disease, and they have dry skin. It's not addressed. Nobody is utilizing, you know, advanced diagnostic modalities like infrared thermometry or skin moisture index, reading skin moisture on admission so that we can risk identify these people at high risk, or the subepidermal moisture changes that we've talked about before, which can identify these problems prior to their clinical complete evolution, prior to their clinical identification. So there's some really interesting things that I'm really just learning about on pressure ulcers that I don't think we've really appreciated before. And like for identification of skin moisture or subepidermal moisture, I think it should be a no-brainer. Any patient admitted to a facility should have these measurements done to make sure that they're not going to get hit with a new pressure ulcer that was evolving prior to that patient ever arriving in their facility. And they're the ones that take the hit for it, you know? So I think there's probably underlying nutritional factors, including anemia. Maybe there's a genetic factor that makes one person susceptible to another. But I think still it's mechanical. It's the extrinsic factors that you say. Pressure, moisture-associated, device-associated pressure injuries. And I just think, how many of these wounds can be prevented just by focusing on prevention, which is my next big thing, even diabetic foot. I do a lot of speaking around the world, probably more than I even do around the country now. Not as much as some of our colleagues who we well know, but I think we need to focus on prevention of all wounds, because for the last 25 about 30 years, we've been focusing on advanced therapies. But with the influx of people into our country who are all at high risk, you know, third world countries are at higher risk for diabetic foot ulcers. You know, people of color, minorities, for some reason, they just have, whether it be diversity, equity, inclusion, all those factors, which I think do play a role. But we do know that people from some parts of the world have a much higher incidence of diabetes due to diet, genetics, and then they're going to have a much higher incidence of these complications. We're never going to be able to address the tsunami of problems that are going to come into our country unless we focus on prevention far more seriously than we did before. And prevention can be simple by screening everybody. You know, if we're talking pressure again, screen everybody for skin moisture content, however you want to do it. Look at them, look at their footwear, do a good clinical skin assessment, look at the subepidermal moisture content, make sure everybody is offloaded, which you expect to be by now. This is nothing new. It's been in guidelines for 30 years, but people still are suffering from these problems. Heel ulcers, I can't believe it. Everybody knows as soon as you're admitted to a hospital, offload those heels, even if it's just under a pillow, under the ankle, to offload the heels. And it's still being done. Now, yeah, we've been talking about end-of-life skin changes. I think that's different. And you know more about that than I do. And Pamela, who will be on your next podcast, knows far more about that than I do. But we have to focus on prevention. You know, we have to, and we haven't focused on it enough. And I think if we do, and I'm talking about from the home to the hospital when that is the case, and into the nursing homes. We, you know, at home we don't have a lot of control, but we certainly have the control far more in the hospital, the acute and the post-acute settings. And we have to start doing much more, or we're going to miss the boat. And you, as a former and nursing home, I'll call you professional administrator, you knew the consequences of one pressure ulcer that occurred on one of your patients while they were in your facilities, and the cost in terms of monetary, financial costs, stress to you, stress to the patients, stress to your staff, especially when they're undergoing all the reviews and litigations and everything. We need to get serious about this. And that's where I think we really need to identify who's at risk. How do we intervene early, before? Is there a genetic component to it like Charcot? And if we can identify those risk factors before the problem occurs, we're going to be much better at preventing the problem, okay, by adding it to what we already know.
And you know, I think one of the things that we spent a fair amount of time at Open Wound Research, and just to correct one thing, I wasn't a nursing home administrator. I was a partner in a group that serviced nursing homes, just for correction for the audience. You know, I think one of the reasons that the prevention element hasn't been well studied is because the tools to measure what could have happened, right, is very difficult, right, under the present regime of statistical analysis. And so I think what excites me at Open Wound Research is our use of Bayesian methods to infer what could have happened in the absence of it actually happening. And so talking to domain experts such as yourself and other members of our group and people in the community and saying, okay, you know, what is our belief at this implicit rate that should occur versus what does occur? And then saying, okay, can we risk stratify and create models that can look at a patient's factors and give us an estimate of a probability of a wound developing,
exactly, right?
And then exactly, targeting efforts towards that. Because I think we've talked about this, you know, in my experience, what I saw in servicing nursing homes was that, you know, 80% of people who had any type of wound with minimal effort could be healed. Just attention, appropriate care.
And early attention, early intervention.
Exactly. But there's 20% of people that, despite that, there's something, some factor that we can't observe directly that's blocking them from healing, you know. And so I think I'm excited about prevention. I'm excited about the idea of secondary prevention. So once you heal that wound, making sure that it does not occur again. And in our data, we've seen that if they occur again, that tail gets dragged out in terms of cost, time to heal, et cetera.
Exciting, though, with the database that you're helping to develop, you're helping, you really are developing it. I'm just very grateful I'm part of the group for Open Wound Research to do this. This registry is just so exciting. We're going to have enough data pretty soon with large enough numbers to really make the identification. That's what's so exciting. It's the numbers. It's always a numbers game. You know, wound care research is still in its infancy, really, and it's not sophisticated. And the biggest lacking is numbers, okay? Because all the studies were, we had 50 patients, we have 100. Oh, we got 300 patients. What? Darn it, now we have 10,000 patients. In a couple of years, we're going to have 20,000 patients. That gets into the range of drug studies, pharmacological studies, where they have these huge numbers. That's what's exciting, because we're going to be able to identify the very things that you're asking about. What makes these patients, especially the recurrent ones, recur, even though we're doing all the good things that we have to? You know, we're going far beyond smoking and far beyond A1C, okay, which are inconsistent risk factors, even for diabetic foot and probably for pressure ulcers as well. And then we got to look at PAD. Well, what level of PAD? Or is it an interaction term? It's PAD times A1C or PAD times neuropathy times anemia. You know, that's what we'll be able to do. But I see the smile on your face. You're as excited about this as I am. My job with Open Wound Research is just to ask the stupid clinician questions, because I don't know these answers. And your job is to make up some gamma hurdle model, Bayesian model that I don't even know about to make these predictions. But that's what's exciting when we combine manpower, you know, with you, with your statistical modeling, plus your team. I don't want to forget Luca and Danette that help, and Ryan and Ryan's team, and me just as the old guy who's been around a long time, who's always the wise guy in the audience, poking questions at people. Why this? Why that? Why didn't you mention this? And I'm just so excited about this in an area, pressure ulcer research, that is, it's really virgin territory for the most part. Not really, but it's really unstudied territory. That's why a year ago we started talking about doing the Open Wound Research Registry, because it's going to be, in 5 years, pressure ulcer research is going to be job number one for all these companies. And we're going to be 5 years into it, well ahead of a lot of people, with a huge, enormous data set. Due to your foresight, Ryan's foresight, and the ability of everybody to get together to manage this, you know. And the team. We have to mention the team God bless them, who are so willing to do whatever stupid questions. You know, I ask them, can you do this? Can you do that? Because I have to make it very simple so that I can see how our dashboards work. And it just gets more and more and more exciting to think about what we're going to be able to do with our liftoff pressure registry. You know, 10,000 patients is pretty exciting for any wound care thing. And we have the resource documentation, the original source documents that we can always go back to, which is more beneficial than these nationwide registries like the Medicare database, the Pearl Diver database, which are limited, but they have outcomes. But we can get right down to the source document, because these are all our own patients. It's just so exciting to me, just because, you know very well, I push for this variable, that variable, this variable, and that one, looking at what we want to do with it down the road. And God bless the team, you know, Luca and Danette and yourself and everyone else who say, yeah, I'll get it. And it's just extracted right from the EHR into our registry. I'm sure other people who might listen to this can be equally excited down the road. It's just fascinating, because we're on treaded territory, you know, and I think I look at the smile on your face because you're as excited as I am about what kind of things we could do, not just modeling, but as we said, what was it yesterday, Swelly? I want to see the modeling and how the modeling is validated by the actual events, by the crude events that we're going to have. And we're going to have such large numbers, which are small deviations, standard deviations, that our numbers are going to be good numbers. And if your modeling, prediction modeling, mirrors that very closely, it's just so exciting, because then we don't need the numbers for some things. We can just extrapolate based on the models that you've developed. So, and I'm not a numbers guy. You know, yeah, I got a degree in quantitative methods, but I told that person, I said, I'm no math person. You don't want me in quantitative methods. And they said, yeah, this is what you want to do. But the numbers, what the numbers can tell us is just so exciting, you know. But let's mirror the large data set, actual numbers and outcomes and percentages healings with what you can do with your predictive models. And boy, when those two merge, or coalesce, or become, let's use a statistical term, when they become coaxial, that's when we really get excited, you know. And I'm looking at the smile on your face because you're as excited about that as I am. And we can only do that with numbers.
Right? Absolutely. You know, what's exciting for me, for you, for the rest of the team, is that this is a real problem that's hurting people and killing people. And as the population in the U.S. gets older, it's only going to get worse. It's not going to get better unless we can do things at scale that make sense. So to me, I lived in that world for 12 years where I saw it every day. And it's something that just spoke to me when we started Open Wound Research and we looked at the Liftoff Registry. We've got about 60 to 120 seconds to go. I want to ask you a question to close out this interview, and it's been fantastic. I appreciate the history, I appreciate the exposition, and I appreciate the passion that you've brought to diabetic foot ulcers. And as my face lit up, your face lit up about pressure ulcers. So I'm excited about that as well. One of the questions I'm going to ask every guest is the following question. If there was a genie, and we'll call them the wound genie, who could grant you any wish in wound care, something that you would like to have.
My name is trademarked, so be careful. There's something in my mind that there is a wound genie trademark out there.
All right. A generic, fantastical, non-commercial wound genie.
There you go. A real live wound genie.
A real live, fantastical wound genie from the Arabian Nights. What would you wish for if there was one thing you could wish for?
Okay, because I did think about this. Obviously, our job is to heal people. And we also know every wound type, and the same type in one individual is different than another. Every wound is a little bit different. And we've almost gone there in some ways, like looking at like a wound dipstick. All right, let's see. This wound has this elevation of proteases. This one has this elevation of proteases. I think I'd like to wave a magic wand over a wound and say, what is deficient in this wound that I need to address? Is there too much excess or too little of this? Whether it be minerals, whether it be nutrients, whether it be MMPs or tissue inhibitors of MMPs, or blood flow, or this or that. Wave a wand over it, tell me what I need. And I think we're coming to that area now. You know, when you look at moleculite, if I'm allowed to use those terms for fluorescent imaging, looking for bacterial burden, when we're looking at the dipstick for elevated levels of proteases, even those are on 100%. So that I want a magic wand, like the phaser, from Star Trek or something like that, that'll tell me, okay, I'm just going to look at this and I'm going to make my diagnosis based on that. I think that's exciting. And then we can do point of care ultrasound that can really look at tunnels and undermining and everything else in osteomyelitis. But if I had one thing, it would be, tell me exactly what I need to do or what I must take away from this wound to get it to heal on its own.
That's a brilliant. That's brilliant. Like a wound phaser. Yeah. Hopefully that's not trademarked either.
No, I don't
think so. Well, listen, it's been fantastic. I again appreciate your time. I appreciate you sharing with the audience. And again, what we're trying to do with this podcast is to do long form discussions with experts where they share about their career, they share about the science, and they share about where they see the wound care world going. And I just think you've done that fantastically. So I appreciate your time and thank you again for being our second guest.
Okay, thanks so much. I'm really angry that I wasn't the first guest though. I'll tell you that as well.
I did that on purpose so that
there'd be
a little bit of animus just to keep things interesting.
No animus at all, no animus. Thank you very much, it was a pleasure. Appreciate
it. Absolutely, thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot.